Hey, it's Greg. This is the Square Pizza Pod, cooked up by Sherm Co.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Square Pizza Pod. In today's episode, Greg is in conversation with Reyna Montoya, who is the founder, CEO, and board member for Aliento. Aliento is a community organization that is DACA, undocumented, and youth-led. They create community healing through art. It reflects the humanity of undocumented immigrants who have been criminalized by the harsh and unjust U.S. detention and deportation system. In this episode, you will learn about dating advice, Reyna's personal connection with Aliento, and how it's touched the lives of over 50,000 people. Most importantly, you will learn about how in-state tuition was taken away from DACA students in 2018, but with their persistence, they helped get an in-state tuition bill on the ballot for 2022. This episode is packed full of knowledge, history, and ways we can help support marginalized groups. Hope you guys enjoy this one.
Reyna, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you, Greg?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for joining the Square Pizza Pod.
I'm excited to be here with you today.
Great. It's awesome. And you're coming from Arizona, is that right?
Yeah, I'm based in the Phoenix Metro. So for people who are familiar in the Gilbert Mesa area.
Okay, perfect. I guess the obligatory question, how's the weather out there today? I'm guessing better than in North Carolina.
Definitely. We're at 66 degrees, so it's pretty nice.
Beautiful. Good for you. I'm glad, jealous, but also happy for you, I promise. And as always, you know, doing some professional, what we call professional stalking / researching before you join, found out you gained a new hiking partner, maybe life partner as well. Is that true?
Yeah, we recently got engaged. We've been together for quite a while now, and we love hiking. Actually, our first date was doing a little hike on December 28th. So eight years later, he proposed. So that was kind of cute.
8 years. Well, that makes me feel better about the length of some of my relationships. That means that maybe I still got time. Well, good for you. Congrats.
Thank you.
Also, you know, I mean, not to get too far off track, but hiking on a first date, I feel like could go one of two ways. There's no middle ground. It's either they're really going to like hiking or they're not going to love it. And you're going to find out pretty quick.
Yeah. I mean, I love hiking and he loves hiking too. So that was something that we have in common. And it was really, you really get to know people in a very different way, I think, when you're hiking through ups and downs. And I think that that's a really good metaphor just in life. You know, there's not always highs and not always lows. And how do you sustain through that?
It's good. I love the dating advice in the first 3 minutes we're getting already. This is perfect. never know where it's going to go. Also didn't realize you were a dancer, had like a pretty serious dance background as well. Can you share more about that?
Yeah. So I started dancing when I was really little, first at wedding parties. My mom, that's when she recently found out that I love dancing. So she always tells the stories that every time that there was a wedding or a party, I would open up the dance floor. And then I started doing more traditional training or formal training when I was about 8 or 9 years old. So I started with the typical tap, jazz, and ballet. And because we migrated, and when I was just 10, I had to stop going to the studio. So then I kind of continued to dance more like non-professionally or non-traditional setting. Yeah. And then when I got to high school, I reconnected with more of the traditional setting. So I took dance in high school and then went to my undergrad and minor in dance. And after I graduated, I decided to do an audition. And, you know, I went to the audition thinking, you know, I'm just going to get a free class. It's going to be really intense. Probably won't make it. I had been healing from my ankle because I twisted my ankle just like a month before. So I was there's no way that I'm going to make it. And I made it. So I danced professionally for about 5 years here in the Valley in the Phoenix metro area. And we got to tour a little bit to Vegas and other parts, but it was predominantly contemporary in the Phoenix metro area.
I mean, I love how you slid in there like professionally really quickly and got to tour a little bit. That's a pretty serious accomplishment, I think.
Yeah, it was really fun. I mean, I did it as a Something that I was really passionate about. I always talk about dance being my healing medicine that really sustained me through very difficult times. And I think that many people can relate having a creative outlet, right? That can be either writing or listening to music sometimes. Sometimes we don't really appreciate how much art is really present in our day-to-day life. So I feel that growing up undocumented, I didn't have a lot of resources that were traditional, the ability to get a therapist or the ability to even go to the doctor. So being able to have even a physical space that can be my living room and being able to express some of the heartbreaks that came with growing up undocumented, having to endure a lot of those difficult things that sometimes it's really hard to articulate in words. I felt that dance really gave me the language to release some of that.
That's great. And I know we have a common, maybe professional overlap in teaching, but where in your journey of life were you a professional dancer? Was it before teaching or during or after?
All of the above.
All the above. Good. So you're side hustle. Side hustle. Good.
Yeah. So before I did the auditions in 2012. So right after I graduated. So I was doing that. And then my full-time job at that time was community organizing and then went to work for like national nonprofits. Mm-hmm. Then afterwards, I joined Teach for America, where I did 2 years of teaching. And I taught 4 different subjects. So I taught English, Spanish, philosophy, and dance. So I developed the dance department at the school that I was at. They had never had a show, a recital. So I put in the first recital for the school. I partnered up with like a community center where we were able to have a full-on theater recital show for the students. That's and great. I was dancing while I was still teaching and doing my master's. I do not recommend doing that. It was a little bit insane. And then, after I founded Aliento and I stopped doing the work in the class, room. I was still doing some projects when we first launched Aliento. Art has always been at the core for us to build that common language. So we opened it up with a workshop with students and families, and I was dancing while a friend was singing. So we had a little motto about we want to show versus tell about what we want to do and invite people to be part of it. So a little bit of everything.
Well, I love that you could bring both of the worlds together, both like the full-time day job and also the nighttime side hustle, but also share that experience with the students you were serving as well.
Yeah, for me, teaching was one of the most humbling experiences that I've ever had. I think that you can probably relate to that. And while I was doing that, I saw that in my dance classes, a lot of students really were able to open up about their own experiences with immigration, with injustices that they were facing. And through my other classes within English and Spanish, I did a lot of project-based learning. So I felt that I was really lucky that students came out as undocumented students for the first time in my class. Wow. I had other students sharing for the very first time that their parents were incarcerated. So we got to create really meaningful connections, and I felt just very humbled and lucky that they trusted me with such stories and being able to connect them to potential resources. So just sometimes it's just a caring word that is like, I see you, I hear you, and just know that you're not alone.
Yeah, it's incredible. I think often think back of all the life lessons my students taught me, right, during teaching and everything else, but also now of how much they're going through, either current students currently in, you know, K-12 education or those that are out with COVID and some of the other kind of life events that are happening right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously I had the privilege of getting to meet you probably almost 4 years ago now in Phoenix with the TFA event around social impact and entrepreneurship, but have loved kind of following the work of Aliento since then. And you guys are almost 5, 6 years old already now. Is that correct?
Yeah, we just turned 5 not too long ago. So we're going on our 6th year almost.
Great. Happy birthday. So it's not an easy accomplishment, as you know. But we'd love for you to give an oversight of the work and the organization you founded and all the incredible work you're doing to support those you serve.
Yeah, of for sure. So for those people who are listening that might not speak Spanish or they're still brushing up in their Spanish skills, aliento translates into breath. But when you give aliento to someone, it's like giving words of encouragement. So really, aliento was born out of my lived experience of growing up undocumented and having all these different levels of intersectionality from the school system, having to be so many doors were closed at me, to then becoming a classroom teacher and doing a lot of advocacy as well, and seeing all the barriers that students really have to navigate within the educational system in order for them to thrive, and how immigration can really impact our lives and we don't even see that. So what we do at Aliento is really, we have this motto that we say we transform trauma into hope and action with the immigrant community. And all about that is really rooted in our healing and the agency of impacted people. We predominantly work with students ages 7 to 24. That's like our bread and butter. But we know that when we're working with young people, we gotta support families. So we take a multi-generational approach. We provide mental health initiatives through arts and healing workshops. We do them in the classrooms and in community with whole families can come and through art explore their own healing journey. We have a fellowship program where we paid students to invest in their leadership that it mirrors the school year. So we really equip them about these are the tools and skills that you need to take in order to become a leader within your community. So how do you create other leaders? And that's really important at Aliento because we truly believe that solutions need to be centered at community. They need to be centered with the most impacted, but it takes a village of people in order to make change. And that's what comes our third approach, which is about, we call it our transform program, where we build allyship and we train educators, counselors, and other folks that really want to support the immigrant community, but they might not know how. That's where we come in. We provide professional development, and we also start talking about those systemic structures from policy or culture that are creating barriers for undocumented and mixed immigration status families to thrive. So we have done a lot of work around the institution access to ensure, regardless of immigration status, people can have access to in-state tuition and scholarships. So those are a few ways that we have really diving into some of the work. And at the center is that our students are powerful. Our students have a voice. They don't need someone to speak for them. They need someone to care about them and give them the tools for them to exercise a beautiful and powerful voice.
So cool. And I think I heard you say 7 to 24. Is those that you serve. And that's an incredible range, but also a wide range. So can you talk about, I think, why, you know, as an organization, you intend and do serve students in that wide of an age gap, and then how you differentiate, of course, like how you support our 7-year-olds to how you support 24-year-olds?
That's a great question. We decided to really invest in the continuum. We see that immigration impacts the lives of students in very different ways. So, and when we're talking about the little ones, there's often this myth that young students or young children, they don't know about immigration. They don't need to learn. But I got to see it firsthand in my own family when my dad was in deportation proceedings. I'm the oldest of three, and I have, at that time, my sister was only 5 years old. My brother was 15 years old, and I was 22. So I got to see all of us. I had just been a recent graduate from college. My brother was in high school. My sister was in kindergarten. And I started seeing how it impacted my family in a very different way. And sometimes we didn't have the language or the tools to express that. And I kept hearing stories after being very open about my own journey. I would talk to little kiddos, age 5, 7, 10, and they didn't know what detention meant. They didn't know what deportation meant, but they knew the fear of having a cop behind you and knowing that that could lead, that was the last time that you would see mom and daddy. I got to see students and bear witness to a lot of the stories of kiddos like crying and not wanting to go to school because they were afraid that that their parents were going to be separated. And they might not know these very complex concepts at that age, but they do know what it is like to fear of not having mom and dad around. So if we're not teaching students the language, or if we're not giving students the tools to cope with that, the trauma is going to be compounded, and that prevents a student learning, that prevents from them to really engage or maybe to develop very unhealthy coping mechanisms. I would say now that I'm very open about my mental health journey, and I became a fighter, and that was my trauma response. So then sometimes rest was a word that didn't exist in my vocabulary. So that's something that now I have to face the consequences, right? It cuts up to you eventually. So being able to let students know that they're not alone and that there's safety, because oftentimes the schools are not those safe havens where they can really share their immigration experience. Oftentimes it's seen as political rather than something that humans go through. So that was really important of why I started at a young age. And then the programming evolves, right? The programming that we would have with young kiddos would be very different, like the fellowship program around more leadership that starts in the high school and connects to higher ed, and something that we decided to focus on that pivotal age of high school and college is because a lot of our students are first generation students, and they don't have like an uncle or a mom or dad that they can call and that they can help them navigate. Oftentimes it's that social capital that we really need in order for us to thrive. So that's why we're thinking about it in the continuum. And then we say, well, after you graduate college, like, we'll support you, but hopefully you become a mentor and you continue to pass it on to the younger generations.
Well, that, and when they go get these wonderful jobs and become very wealthy, they donate back to the organization to sustain it as well, right?
Yeah, that's the hope. I mean, it's really inspiring to see that even some of our current students are the ones who are giving up like a Starbucks drink and doing a $5 monthly donation. And that has been really inspiring for me, that it's about cultivating that value of paying it forward, and that it takes a village. We all need that extra helping hand. And how do we make sure that we're setting that value at a very young age?
I think it's so important, you know, whether it's talking to 7-year-olds around, you know, their documentation status, or introducing them to new algebra concepts. It's often, in my experience, the adults that are holding them back from developing. But when, you know, you create the right environment, the safe space to talk to them about academic issues or real world issues, humans and students and even younger ones can be very resilient and open to understanding how to navigate them when adults help them kind of introduce those right terms, those right experiences. I just feel like it's always the students that can are ready to receive it when the adults, I think, can be mature enough or set up the right opportunities for those students to receive it.
Yeah, and I think that is so incredible to work with students at that age, because as I mentioned, sometimes they don't have the language, but you give them a piece of paper, a Canva and painting and colors. And the questions are like, we don't really go right away into the trauma, right? Because that's not building that resilience. Yeah. But we ask them, hey, why don't you draw a picture about something that gives you hope or that you're afraid? Bringing back the choice, right? That they can have that choice and engage in student agency. And that's when we learn about these stories about a student drew bars, and then you see a person in one side and the other person on the other side. So when we were asking questions, we're like, oh, can you tell us a little bit about what you drew? Yeah. And then he started sharing that he's like, oh, this is a wall. And it's like my biggest fear is that my mom would get to be deported and I'm in one side and she's in the other. So, oh, I'm like choking up. But I mean, I think that sometimes what we don't get as adults is that regardless if we hear these stories or not, our students are feeling that and they're imagining that what that could look like for them. And I think it is our moral responsibility to support them and give them the tools to process something as traumatic as that.
Yeah. And I love so much of, we think about this word a lot in our own work and with the work we do to support partners, but I know how intentional you are when you say co-create solutions and co-create plans with those that you serve. And I think I know, but can you share more why that phrase is used so often in the work that you guys do?
I think it goes back to that value that we really believe that the people who are most impacted have the solutions. And sometimes they might not have the language, they might not have the right tools, but they have such a brilliant insight. I think my most empowering experiences has been working with students and seeing that light in their eyes when you tell them, okay, you hate this, this is not fair, the world is unjust, so like, what are we going to do about it? Mm-hmm. And then their eyes just start lighting up about imagining an alternative. And they are so smart and they always, always, always have the best answers. So it's just about giving them that coaching. And I think oftentimes we as adults or people who have experience working with youth, we can be afraid at times to not only like take a leap of faith, but also understand our role, because we also have valuable insights. And co-creation, it takes the whole community to do that. And what we meant by that is like, we are very specific about, yes, we want to listen to our young people, we want them to drive the change, but our young people still need mentorship. Our young people still need some guidance, because they might have the greatest idea, but they might not know exactly what it's going to take in order to make it happen. And I think that that's where we can really be utilizing our resources and putting it like a potluck, right? Like, I'll bring the beans, you'll bring the tortillas, you'll bring the dessert. And that's how we really make change, when every person feels included and feels part of something bigger than themselves.
I have to imagine I know you've seen such great success with that focus on co-creation, because not only do they have those closest to the challenge have the solutions, but when they have a team and an organization like yours, so many things can happen together at once, that can happen faster rather than things happening in isolation. And I think that has to allow you guys to create such powerful results at the same time.
Yeah, it's been really humbling. I mean, the most recent accomplishment that we have had was around in-state tuition, and that really came out of us listening to our students. In Arizona, oftentimes has been seen as an epicenter of so much hate and anti-immigrant rhetoric for the immigrant community. And now we're turning that into an epicenter of hope. And during this time, DACA students were allowed to have in-state tuition, and then there was litigation happening. Long story short, in-state tuition was taken away from DACA recipients in 2018. And our students were crying, our students were devastated. And then we started imagining, like, what is it going to take to change this? How do we make sure that we're changing this so no other generation can go through that heartbreak? And in 2018, a few months after, we decided to launch a campaign of Arizona's Future. And that's how we kick off our fellowship model, because we said students need to be at the center. And what would it look like to really invest in them? One of my colleagues as well, he was impacted by this policy, and myself when we were in high school. And then he created the bill, he started talking to students, we were saying like, well, you know, like, politics and policy is not as easy, so what would it look like, what is acceptable, what's not acceptable, what would be a win, what's better than the status quo. So we started doing all of that work with students, and we went in the 2019 legislature, we got a sponsor, a Republican sponsor, to back us up. And it passed in the Senate, never got heard in the House of Representatives, because the Speaker of the House blocked it. So, of course, we were devastated. We organized over 300 students who came to the Capitol to talk to every single elected official. And, you know, there was those moments of doubt, but we said we have a choice. We either we get, give up, or we come back at it again. 2020, we came back at it again. We were at the hype, we got another, and now we started in the House of Representatives. We got a sponsor in the House of Representatives, also Republican, who decided to take the leap of faith. And we were like, okay, we're nonpartisan, this is about the issue. And then the pandemic happened. So all the momentum died, and rightfully so, right? Like, priority needed to be our health. And the legislature started focusing about COVID response and all of that. And again, we were at this moment of choice. So we came back in 2021 and we got bipartisan support. We got sponsors in the Democrats and in the Senate, in Republicans, and we made it happen. And it passed in the House, it passed in the Senate. We were able to widen our support of allies. So our students were talking at churches, they were talking at schools, they were creating this momentum. And there was a point that we felt that we were not going to make it happen. But then now it's going to be up to Arizona voters to decide whether undocumented students and dreamers have an opportunity to have in-state tuition and access to scholarships. So it's going to be in the ballot. And a lot of it happened because there was pain and there was heartbreak, but there was so much hope that things can be different if we put the hard work and we put the students at the center.
I mean, incredible, right? Like, how do you respond? I mean, that's a movie in itself, right? Just the amount of persistence to do it, but also just to get Republicans and Democrats to work together in any state and to get so close as you guys are. So when it goes on the ballot in November?
In November 2022, yeah. This year. Yeah.
So I'm guessing we have some campaigns coming up to make sure that that passes.
Correct. There's going to be a lot of work that needs to be done. And at the end of the day, I think it goes back to, regardless of the policies, about reminding students and also adults and communities that that change is not going to be quick and it's not going to be easy. And we're going to face a lot of barriers. But at the end of the day, like, the human spirit is so resilient, and we have the ability to bring the heart and the brains together, right? To make change. And that's why I'm walking away very inspiring, even despite our political system being so polarized and seeing so much division, that there's still opportunity if we're coming from a place of building consensus and building where there's that opportunity of where there's agreement. There's agreement around that. So why don't we start there? And that doesn't mean we stop there, right? And there's so many other injustices, but we got to start somewhere. And how do we make sure we stay grounded in that?
And speaking in positives, of course, this bill will pass in November. So when it does pass, how many DACA students will it cover? Like, how many DACA students are you guys supporting in Arizona right now?
Yeah, so every single year, approximately 2,000 undocumented students graduate our high schools each year. Okay. So it's going to be ongoing. Immediately, sure. 2,000 students can be benefited from that. But when you're looking at the pool of people, we're talking about, depending on the studies, between 100 to 103,000 students or adults that can be eligible. So, for example, we see a lot of folks that stop going to college because of the dramatic increase of tuition. They could potentially, like, qualify as long as they graduated from an Arizona high school and then they meet those requirements in order to be college ready. They can re-enroll and have that great opportunity of higher education.
I mean, so powerful to think about when it passes, just the amount, I think the fair opportunity those students and families will have to attend college without being burdened with debt, right? And then the futures that will hold, but also probably going to be a shining example for other states that don't have this legislation that can look to you guys for guidance around how they pass it within their state as well.
And hopefully it also serves as an inspiration that there's a difference between governing and campaigning, right? And that elected officials have a moral responsibility to govern. And that even though that we're constantly in an election cycle, how do we go beyond the binaries of Republican and Democrat good versus bad, but about that there can be an example that institutions can work if people who are impacted are at the center and don't give up. Because if we give up in our institutions and if we don't try to make them better, then it looks pretty bad and it looks pretty dark for us. And hopefully it serves like as a little light of hope that that government can function if the right pieces are there.
It better, right? And we need it too, because like you said, if not, then what are we doing? We'll certainly be tracking that and supporting you from afar over the next few months moving into November, and love the work that we just got into that you talked about. But also want to highlight the focus on art, because we're talking about Republicans and Democrats and passing really important legislation and supporting students and undocumented immigrants. But there's a core component of art to the work that maybe isn't obvious to a lot of people. So can you speak more about why art and how that work is used to set a foundation to get bills like this passed?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think for me, As I was sharing a little bit earlier, as a dancer, as someone who has been able to utilize art as a vehicle to heal, I think that sometimes we take that for granted, and we don't understand the challenges that we as humans go, right? For me, in this case, as someone who grew up undocumented, who has DACA, I constantly have to live in 2-year increments of not knowing if this administration is going to be for me, it's going to be against me, or it's going to say really beautiful things about immigrants, but still don't change my quality of life. Like, we have a Biden administration that has done nothing for DACA recipients. So I think that I constantly think about the ups and downs that creates for the mental health of individuals, and how these emotions can be so complex that are oftentimes difficult to articulate. So that's why we use art. There's a lot of research-based evidence around how art is a powerful tool for healing and to give people language. So the way that we do that, we provide arts and healing workshops. We do them in the school as like after school programming. Yep. And we also do them in community on Saturdays. And we get to use different themes. Like, we have used painting, and then our theme is colors and emotions. And then we get to explore emotions through different colors. And students and families can create beautiful art pieces that really taps into their creativity and maybe share stories that they were not that comfortable in sharing. And all these spaces are co-created in community, and they're facilitated by oftentimes impacted folks that have gone through the same journey. And then they get training around trauma-informed pedagogy so that we can really utilize that. And oftentimes we start to stigmatize mental health, and it's been really beautiful to see even sometimes our volunteers saying, because of this workshop, I started going to therapy, or having our students wanting to join some of our group therapy sessions that we do in partnership with therapists that are licensed. So it's been really powerful to see how this sometimes becomes an opening of someone investing in the healing journey, because we have had many stories that I can go on and on, but just to crystallize it for folks listening, is that oftentimes we're going to face no, and we're going to face people that don't have the best intentions. So how do we cope with that? And that's what we do at our workshops through art, is letting them know that that can be a coping mechanism, and that can be a tool in our toolkit that we can utilize. And we do a lot of that because it's building that resilience and reclaiming that agency for our communities that oftentimes not only have been marginalized, but excluded from very basic decisions in their lives.
And imagine some of the, you know, quote unquote, adults and elected officials could use some experience in that art therapy, and maybe just therapy in general, to be better humans at the same time.
I mean, definitely
our might be a new program offering for you guys to do. Yeah, it might be
in the future.
New line of business. That's right. maybe they won't be as easy to work with or enjoyable to work with, but they could probably benefit from it, would be my guess. And right, I know you guys have so much going on in the bill you just mentioned coming up in November, and so many other aspects of the program. But when you think about success for your organization, what does success look like for you as a leader?
When I think about success, I think that every single person that comes in contact with Aliento is committed to doing things differently. That is, oftentimes we live in a world where we're seeing so much polarization that it's so easy to dehumanize one another. And if we really want to make sure that our human potential, and we're really uplifting the humanity of immigrants, we have to uplift the humanity of every single person, even the people that we disagree. So I hope that for me, success is seeing students like Darian, who just graduated from high school last year and now is going into Harvard. He finished his first semester at Harvard.
Wow.
And he came back for the summer here in Arizona. And guess what he's doing? He's doing a small contract job with us, training the other fellows that are getting ready to go talk to elected officials. So for me, is that, so cool. That is that value of instilling in individuals, one, that you have the power to change things, two, that you have the power to relate to other people at a human level, even though if you disagree, how can you share your vision and your opinion about the world you want to see without dehumanizing others? And then three, is that you're paying it forward, because at the end of the day, if Aliento is here 5, 10 years from now or not, hopefully we have built enough leaders that they are leading in different ways, whether in the classroom, whether in politics, whether as doctors or secretaries or nurses, that they are committed to living a life of purpose and value.
And I know so much of the work you do is obviously having success, but it can be tough at times, as you said, with trauma and supporting your undocumented students and families and trying to get Republicans and Democrats to work together. But amidst kind of all that, like, what's something that's giving you hope as you're doing the work day by day?
I think for me, what gives me hope is going back to seeing students like Deya and Daria. And as I was mentioning to you, I think about Deya, who was not comfortable sharing her immigration status. And when we had this huge victory right after almost 4 years in the making, she was at the press conference and she addressed the press and she addressed politicians who were there in the community. And she made a commitment. She made a commitment, whether this legislation probably is not going to benefit me now, it's going to benefit so many other students. And I'm being committed to sharing about my immigration journey so then other people see who we are as immigrants. And I'm going to continue to fight for education equity. And I think for me, that's what gives me hope, that someone who had experienced something so shameful about disclosing their immigration status is really transforming that into an aspect of their lives that can give them power and that can give them value and perspective and say, I'm going to put my community first. Because at the end of the day, if we constantly put ourselves first and we don't think about the community, solutions are not going to be made. So that's what gives me hope during those tough moments when I want to quit or when a budget is not working or where grants are giving me all these rejections or where politicians are not listening. I think I go back to students like Deya and Darian that have this belief that things can be done differently and that we can do so much better as a society.
Yeah, I think that's right, and where all the work starts, right? And also want to encourage people to go to your website, because even outside of just like the programmatic work you do, the resources and the guides on your website are really incredible, that help educate myself that the issues and current things that to support DACA and families living with DACA and just other topics as well. So I think want to make sure, one, give you guys a shout out, but two, make sure others go to check out those important resources on your website.
Yeah, definitely come check us out at alientoaz.org. We provide now some virtual programming that also people outside of Arizona can join. We have a footprint in 44 different states. So you can join our Arts and Healing, our open mics. There's also toolkits that we create. I know with DACA, there's always constant changes on immigration. You don't have to memorize it. If you're an educator or an administrator or a counselor, feel free to check out our resources and we'll be happy to connect you with either like a local community in your state or in your city, or be able to populate resources. As I said, we have a footprint in 44 states that have joined and use our resources. So we're always happy to share them out, from mental health to education access, to the constant ongoing change on the immigration law. You don't have to be an expert, you just have to care. That's what we tell our people, that we're not expecting you to be an expert. We have like Aliento and other folks that are doing this day to day, and partnership and collaboration is really important. And the only thing that you need to do is to care about your fellow brothers and sisters that are living in a tough situation.
I appreciate that, Grace, because there's so much going on. And if you're not in it, like you guys are day by day, you don't really know what's going and what's happening. And so important for you all and nice of you all to give that grace so those that do care can engage in whatever way they feel comfortable with to understand the issues, even as fluid as they are sometimes. Raina, what's one thing our audience can do to support you and your work at Aliento?
One thing that they can do is to follow us on social media. That goes long ways, from sharing information to folks that might be impacted, to maybe you educating yourself, to also donating. Honestly, donations, that's how we sustain our work. So then if you're willing to take that even extra step, I'm giving you two calls to actions that you can do. One is to follow us on social media, get the resources that you need, share those resources. And then two, maybe you're you're taking the example as a student that I mentioned to you, and then maybe you're not taking that, you're not spending $5 in that coffee once a month, and you're donating us to us so we can continue to do this incredible work of providing healing spaces and co-creating solutions with the immigrant community.
We'll definitely make sure we push out all that contact information when this goes live so people can find it as well. Randa, last question. What does Square Pizza remind you of?
I think it reminds me of my like childhood, because every time I'm a very visual person, so I always think about like, oh, it's such a fun thing to do, and you can always bring different ingredients and make something special out of it.
I like that. It's like you pulled on some of your art background there to pull that together. That's great. Randa, any final thoughts you want to leave our audience with?
Just know that you're not alone, and that I know that people probably who listen to this podcast are people that really care about our education, really care about our students and our families. So just know that even in the midst of darkness, you can be a light, and don't be afraid to shine your light, and know that you're not alone, and that maybe hopefully in the darkest skies, if we're all shining our very unique light, we can brighten up even the darkest skies in this world. So it's an invitation for you all to be reminded that you're not alone, and that you can be a powerful light in this world.
I appreciate that invitation. I imagine our listening audience does as well. Randa, thanks so much for who you are and all that you're doing for you and your team, and for those that you serve. And thanks so much for joining the podcast today.
Thank you so much for the invitation, Greg. It was so good to connect with you.
Thanks so much for checking out the Square Pizza Pod, making a few selfish requests. If you enjoyed the episode, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps spread the word about the podcast, and share this with a friend. We appreciate it. Thanks.